Hi everyone, my name is Mike Consul. I'm a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute and a blogger at the site Rorty Bomb, and I'm joined by
Sarah Leonard, an editor at Dissent and at the New Inquiry.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty well. It's a pretty decent afternoon, and this is another installment of Fireside Chats, the Roosevelt Institute's show on bloggingheads.tv. Where we take people from the fellows program at Roosevelt Institute and pair them with people we find interesting. And I'm a big fan of both Dissent Magazine and the New Inquiry, of which you're both involved with. And I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about both for people who may not be familiar with them.
Sure. So Dissent Magazine was founded in 1954 by Irving Howe, and it comes out of the sort of Marxist left in New York, the New York intellectuals. And it was a magazine that was designed to bring all kinds of radical voices together on the left, and has evolved over time as a defender of democratic socialism or social democracy. It's currently edited by Michael Walzer and Michael Kazin. And it's been over decades just an institution of serious sort of long-form leftist critique based in New York. And then the New Inquiry is a very different beast. It was founded recently. It's online only, and it has a sort of collective of young editors, most of whom are based in Brooklyn, most of whom are precariously employed, work in some form, maybe in publishing, maybe freelancing, and has written a lot more, as you would expect, about technology, precarious employment, those sorts of things. And together, they've formed part of this growing orbit of little magazines in New York, and you'll see writers traveling sort of among them. So I bring New Inquiry people into Dissent pretty regularly, and I obviously write for both, and you see sort of a conversation happening between them.
Yeah, we've had Peter Fraze on the show before, who I believe has contributed to New Inquiry, and yeah. Aaron Beatty as well, who is one of your bloggers there. You've brought on several bloggers at New Inquiry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, one thing we wanted to do was be able to both publish people regularly and frequently who we really love, and also have time to spend a lot of time editing long-form essays in the way we feel they should be edited. So one way we do that for our readers is by bringing on these really wonderful bloggers who cover sort of a range of topics and who we don't edit. We brought on their blogs because we love them as they are. And so we have them publishing every day. And then that frees us up to spend a lot of time doing what editors are really meant to do. And that for us solves one problem that's been big in little magazines, which is how do you publish online all the time and still have time to produce something of quality. So that's what we're doing. So Aaron Beatty is a wonderful political blogger based in California, has covered the cuts in the UC system, has really kind of covers everything. It's obscene how much he reads. He has a recurring feature called Sunday Reading that is spectacular that I would recommend. And some of our other bloggers are Autumn Whitefield Medrano, who covers beauty and ideas of beauty in the media, makeup, all kinds of things that if women's magazines were sort of critical and brilliant would cover. And Rob Horning, who's one of our editors, has a blog that covers the intersection of technology and social life. So just there's been this amazing explosion of bloggers who we're really proud to host.
Yeah, you have one there called Austerity Kitchen, I think, which was a previous blog, but it's moved over there now. Is that correct?
And, yes.
It's all about discussing how people prepare food under times of extreme economic distress and interweaving commentary with it. It's just, I think it's like this undiscovered gem of the blogosphere, which is this amazing way of incorporating, like really trying to place people in times of economic stress, including now, and then extrapolating out to other things. Like it's very amazing how well it works. And I think it's just one of the things I discovered through the site. New Inquiry also has this business model that I really like. I'm a big fan of both Dissent and New Inquiry, but New Inquiry has a thing where it's $2 a month and you get a specially edited web magazine that comes as a PDF or other kinds of online or, you know, tablet reading formats. And it's a lot of these sites, I noticed it with a bunch of different sites that we'll discuss a little bit later, you know, there's just so much content on the internet that, like, I try to keep up with a lot of it, but I know that a lot of the best stuff, I'm missing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have this kind of edited volume of the best stuff, plus maybe some original content, which I understand how it's done, is super useful, because it's kind of like, if I just didn't get a chance to read a lot online last month, here I'm getting, like, the best stuff from the site. So I highly recommend checking them both out. I'm kind of curious, as someone who obviously thinks a lot and is very involved with publications on the left, and here I'm going to take a really broad view of the left, just meaning left liberal to much more radical. You know, past couple years have obviously been very stressful for everyone involved with publishing and the dissemination of left ideas. And, you know, two big events. One was the economic stress of the American Prospect, where they're currently put out an emergency fundraising letter.
Yeah.
And then last week was layoffs at Good Magazine, which was taken over and substantially revamped by a ex-American Prospect editor named Ann Friedman, who is a remarkably talented editor.
Yeah.
And her along with Tim Fernholz, who's also from the Prospect, who wrote a lot about financial reform, and Amanda Hess, who writes a lot about other things, were let go from Good Magazine, even though, you know, I think it's well established that they did a great job expanding both its reach and its ability to produce left liberal ideas in the greater discourse. So I'm kind of curious how you see the challenges and the potential strengths of going forward, of getting ideas out through a variety of writing techniques.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that's certainly the challenge. The situation with the American Prospect and Good has been distressing, but it's also, as you say, emblematic of something that's been happening for a long time. You can read a lot for free on the internet. It's hard to cultivate subscriptions in the same way as has traditionally been done. The advantage that, to my mind, little magazines have, and little magazines is a term that's referred to, you know, over time, a lot of more and less well-known magazines, so something like the Partisan Review, something like Dissent, and now new, often online ones like the New Inquiry and Jacobin. One of their advantages, to my mind, is that they necessarily are built on small communities, and those communities identify very strongly with a particular voice or a particular politics, and they will go out of their way to support those magazines. So Dissent would not have survived since 1954 without a strong community of people who care deeply about keeping it going. And they don't just subscribe, they donate money, they donate time, they host parties. All of those things are really, really critical. And so at the New Inquiry, when we put out this magazine, all of those articles are available over time for free online. You don't have to pay to read anything in that magazine, because we've realized that that would be a losing battle. And also, we don't actually want people to have to pay for knowledge. And so our model instead has been to cultivate a community of people who care about this writing and ask them to support us by paying $2 a month. And in return, we'll put together this collection. We'll make it really, really beautiful. So we are giving them something. But at the same time, the subscription model, such as magazines used to have, doesn't really seem to be feasible to us. But that, I'm a lot more hopeful now than I was even a couple of years ago. Mark Greif just wrote about this in the New Statesman. There are all these little magazines coming out, and seemingly in defiance of all the economics of publishing we've been told. That the New Inquiry is thriving, Jacobin, N Plus One, Triple Canopy. These are thoughtful, really smart little magazines, and they're surviving. And I think that is quite significant.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the right, I think there's a lot more. Well, there's just a lot more money in some ways. And
yeah.
I think there's a lot more of an assumption that some of these things should be run as a loss. Like you look at something like National Review, Commentary, a couple of the other big right-wing intellectual journals or magazines, and it's just clear that some oil baron's responsibility to shepherd it through, and then, you know, they're going to lose money, but they'll be okay with it. One thing I'm kind of curious is how much has online-ness, you know, the culture of reading things online, expanded the possibilities for further left discussion. I had a friend once who, this was many years ago, maybe like 2006 or 7, said, the left should not actually be afraid of the decline of newspapers, because local newspapers are a seriously conservative institution that are a check on a lot of real possible change at the local level. And in so much as that Craigslist is going to destroy local papers, they're probably going to destroy local papers that are run by local interests, that, that really reflect a much more conservative, non-labor union, people who exist at the margins of society. And that's a real opportunity to step into a public space of discussion. I don't know if I actually buy that, but I think it's a really fascinating argument. And I'm kind of curious, there's obviously, it's harder to maintain a profitable institution in this environment, but has it opened up the space for dialogue a further step to the left than, say, during the Clinton years or the Bush years?
Yes. I think it has on some level. There are discussions you'll see happening largely in the blogosphere that aren't really happening other places and certainly would not happen in big newspapers. So to pick something we're going to actually discuss a little later, the debate around the word precarity, what does this mean about the way labor is arranged now? What does it mean about how we organize that so many of us are contingently employed? What are its implications for the left, but also for public policy? These are debates that have been engaged in by people at both little left magazines, people in the sort of liberal blogosphere, people, even bloggers at the big newspaper websites. And that strikes me as a change. But it's always an open question how many people or what sorts of people those debates are finding. So everybody reads the New York Times, but does everyone engage in a debate happening between you, Peter Fraze, and Matt Iglesias? I really don't know. You might have a better sense than I of who's able to tap into those conversations.
Cool. Well, you brought up the word precarity, and it's something I read about, I think, first in Dissent, this year. You had John Schmidt from our friends over at CEPR talk about a book review over the word precarity. And you organized or moderated a panel on precarity at Left Forum earlier this year. And I think a lot of people understand that something is changing about the labor markets, both within this economic crisis that we've been going through for the past couple of years, but also part of a longer-term change. And so precarity is obviously a great word, but I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand what's going on with it. So could you define it and talk a little bit about what the debate is about where labor is going?
Sure. So Mark Schmidt was reviewing a book in Dissent called The Precariat.
It's John Schmidt, right? It was John Schmidt. I'm sorry. Sorry.
How do you keep track of writers? It's not possible.
There's so many Schmidts.
Yes. You're right. And he was reviewing a book by Guy Standing called The Precariat, The New Dangerous Class. And what this is talking about is the rapid rise in contingently employed workers. So people who do not spend their entire career in one place, people who don't belong to a union, who have limited job security. And this can range really from, say, a freelance web designer to a migrant laborer. And so a lot of the debate has been over whether it makes any sense to put people like that in one category, what kind of work that does for our thinking. And so there have been a lot of theoretical debates. Is the precariat a class? Can you have a class that is defined not by its relation to a certain level of wage work, but instead by the degree of contingency of the labor that is done? And that's been sort of a theoretical debate that's been very popular in the left blogosphere. And then there are larger questions that organizers in particular have been addressing, such as if you are all working in different places, say if you're a home care worker and you're dispersed among many private homes, how will you ever organize? How do you avoid exploitation? And yeah, so when we had this conversation at Left Forum, it was very interesting. We had a mix of organizers and writers, and all representing sort of different constituencies. And the goal is to figure out, does this term precarity make any sense? If it makes sense, how do different groups of contingently employed people work together? Do interns have anything in common with a domestic worker? And that's how we got that conversation sort of started and off the internet.
Awesome. So yeah, there's a couple ways to approach it. My colleague Dorian Warner has discussed with me a bunch of times in various online forums about how a lot of our labor law and about how a lot of our labor institutions, which go back to the New Deal, mm-hmm. which we're fascinated with here, are really gendered constructed. They're really predisposing the idea that you're going to have a male breadwinner.
Yes.
In every household. And the labor law reflects that kind of work atmosphere. And part of that has to go back to excluding black workers who were often more contingent to bring in Southern Democrats, but also the idea that our economy would involve much more care work and a lot less manufacturing over the next, at this point in the 21st century, I don't think was reflected in the law. And there's, I've seen a lot of debates about whether or not the law is something to tackle or something to ignore. But let's start by discussing the question you brought up is, in what ways can we think of, a young 20-year-old worker who has a lot of student debt, who is working essentially temp jobs over and over again, in what way do they have solidarity and matching and conflicting interests with someone who is, let's say, a migrant worker or someone who is an undocumented home care worker, someone who is what we would consider much more marginalized by traditional class and gender and race standards?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. That's sort of the million-dollar question, and in some ways we're figuring that out. But I would say that...
are the arguments people put forward, even if we don't come to an answer, just to kind of get a landscape?
So there are a few ways that different sort of classes of people can still intersect in their interests and find some common ground. So if you take the university, take Yale... Yale is a wealthy university in a working class town, often with middle class-ish, however you want to define that, students, graduate students, and various kinds of faculty, some of whom are incredibly contingent, some of whom have life tenure. And right now, something that's happening at Yale in particular is the graduate students are attempting to organize a union. The university has tried to prevent this forever, and it's failed more than once. There's actually, I found in Dissent's archives, a pamphlet from the early 90s on how to organize as a graduate student that a union paid to distribute on Yale's campus, and one of our writers put together. So this has been going on for a while. But one of the things that happens there is the graduate students have been doing a lot of work with the clerical workers who are already unionized, working to support their union, and the clerical workers, in turn, do work to help the graduate students figure out how to unionize. And they recognize that, first of all, they have a common enemy, and that can happen in with any institution, but in this case, they have a common enemy, essentially, of the Yale administration, which is not interested in unionization. And they have... common sense of what it's like to be made contingent in this environment. So the graduate students have no way to collectively bargain. The clerical workers won the right to collectively bargain because Yale is such a dominant force in New Haven that without winning that right, Yale utterly dictates the terms of employment there. So there is this sort of finding common ground, and Max Frazier, who was on the panel and is both a Yale graduate student and a very fine labor journalist, talked about organizing the shop wall to wall, which is a very old school phrase, right? That is old school labor organizing, but brought into a new context.
Can you explain what that means for people who may not know?
Sure. It means what it sounds like, just unionizing everybody within a single workplace. And so... the ways in which they help each other do that both exemplify and create types of understanding about different kinds of employment. I think that's a fairly good example of the sort of thing that could happen, but there are many others in many other contexts.
So I'm going to ask a question that's a little it's very simplified, but I think it's a useful framework to discuss it, is that I saw it a bit in the Schmidt review of the book he was reviewing is precarity is obviously a word that is set up to be a negative. Mm-hmm. People pay for insurance. They obviously do not like precarity. But how much is this new workforce something to embrace? Which is to say, a lot of the intellectual framework over how the economy should relate to people is all about entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship of the self, as Foucault would say. Mm-hmm. And there is something that's backwards looking about the idea that, you know, we should go back to something where we have mass unionization and this kind of idea of the workforce as a blob, as a kind of mid-century Fordist contract. And how much should we be focusing left energies? And this is not to embrace a kind of libertarian view of the marketplace, but how much should we be expanding and changing tactics towards the idea that people will never have consistent employment and people will come in and out of the workforce as they choose and jobs will be come and go much more, you know, in nature of the way capitalism is changing is the way in nature of the way technology is changing. How much do you sense there's a tension between people and it's in Marx and Engels a bit too, you know, how much did they want to organize an industrial workforce versus how much do they want to go back to kind of artisan production of, you know, the early 19th century. How much do you view that conflict between mass organizing versus creating a safety net around the self play out in these debates about labor?
Yeah, that's a debate that's been, it's been tricky to have because it is so stratified along class lines, right? So freelancers who do web design take some amount of, there is a social value placed on not having a boss, being free to do what you want. A domestic worker has no illusions that they are flexible in some sort of good way, right? These are very different discourses that exist around these different kinds of contingent labor. I do think that it's true that nobody wants to go back to factory work. The idea that we would just roll backwards, I think, is ridiculous, both for obvious economic reasons, as in it's not going to happen, and second, that nobody liked it. Nobody really enjoys working in a factory. It's not much. It's not something that, as an organizing principle, it's really useful to aspire to, especially when people don't really think it's realistic. So I think one like sort of wonderful example of what it means to organize with precarious labor is this weekend, actually, I was at a kickoff conference for something called Caring Across Generations. And this is a enormous coalition of both traditional labor unions and non-traditional labor, not unions, but organizations like the Domestic Workers Alliance. And a number of sort of activist or advocacy member organizations. And they pointed out over the course of this conference that care work is going to be an increasingly enormous portion of the American economy, especially as the population ages. And so addressing that reality and organizing around it is inevitable if we want those people to have any power in determining how they can control their own lives under this economy. So what they're doing is organizing both workers and employers, and organizing within bringing domestic workers together within both cities and suburbs, the sorts of people who are thinking only in terms of traditional labor unions could not imagine organizing because they're so spread out, are actually in fact being organized. And looking at the domestic workers union is something I would absolutely recommend doing if you can, and is a really good example of that. Passed the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights in New York, and did it with the help of the SEIU, but did it through new forms of organizing. And I think that's the future of labor organizing. I think it's completely fascinating. And I think it's in its advocacy of direct engagement with politics, very different from something like the Freelancers Union, which is essentially a nonprofit that has recently sort of sprung up to allow freelancers to collectively buy health insurance. But it's still fairly expensive, and it's not a super politically engaged project.
Over the weekend, I hosted a Fire Dog Lake book salon, which we'll put a link to with, I'm going to butcher his name, but Gar Elperwitz.
Yeah,
who we talked about his book, America Beyond Capitalism, which was a mm-hmm. 2005 book that was recently reissued. And, you know, one of his main arguments is that the social welfare model that built up after the New Deal was much more dependent on a strong labor union than we appreciated, than many people appreciate. And the fact that a lot of these institutions are collapsing, the fact that it seems like, you know, the 1% is emboldened, it's very difficult to move even, you know, small piecemeal institutions to kind of hold, you know, corporate power in 1%, is a result of the fact that we don't have a strong countervailing force, to use the Galbraith term, in labor unions. And he said, you know, one thing you need to look at is how to localize and democratize work. And either through, in his mind, it's all worker co-ops, or, you know, that's a big part of it. And to me, this, you know, organizing a lot of caring work is going to involve that kind of thing, because it's not a traditional kind of monopoly power that you can organize. It's not a traditional factory worker. It's harder to organize strikes in the same way, because the location of where the work is done is not isolatable enough to really cause a site of contention. But what you just described strikes me as very in tune with that. It's a way of both, you know, empowering workers on the local scale, but also getting real demands accomplished in a way that builds on those successes. So I think that's very, very interesting. One other thing, and this will hopefully segue us a little bit, is one thing, especially, so it seems like there's often two problems, right, when you talk about precarity, right? So there's one hand, there are people who, for a variety of reasons, exist at the marginalities of the formal economy. And it's very difficult sometimes to get, you know, undocumented workers are the most common person here, because there it's something where their ability to exercise their full legal rights and their full civil rights, which include a right to organize, are going to be challenged just by legal structures, and not just random legal structures, but legal structures that are often designed to intimidate or harass them, to self-deport, as the common phrase in the Republican right now. And on the other hand, you have, I won't say upper middle class, but you have the way that middle class work, the mechanisms of reproducing it seem to be breaking down. And this is where debates about internships seem to kick in. It's where debates about something Dissent wrote, which I thought was an amazing piece several years ago by Jeffrey Williams, about the idea of student debt as a form of indenture. Which I think is a really – but the way in which talented people who are coming up through the meritocracy are able to then formalize their skills in the economy itself and start to take over rungs of power – is breaking down. And that's where you see reproductions of wealth, because people who are wealthy can have their kids not graduate with debt, so they have more opportunities. They can pay for unpaid internships. But that kind of – the idea of the meritocracy as a means to actually reproduce a ruling class that is actually talented and capable is breaking down under both mass inequality and also the ways in which we normally structured work and education and reproduction of talent is also collapsing. So I'm kind of curious, how do you see a lot of these? Because I know Intern Nation stuff, there's a book called Intern Nation, really get people animated and talking. And I'm kind of curious how you read a lot of those debates. Is this a big nothing, or is this a real serious problem that needs a solution?
Well, there are a lot of questions wrapped up in that. And I would start by saying maybe that, of course, the American meritocracy has always been a myth, and that people with who make it to the top tend to consolidate their position at the top and consolidate it for their children. And what's happening now is, in fact, an intensification of those mechanisms. Ross Perlin's book, Intern Nation, is a good example. As he points out, internships have become basically required in order to get a job in white collar work of almost any kind, but particularly in the really powerful industries of politics, media, Hollywood, finance. And obviously in order to take an internship, which is almost always unpaid, you have to already have money. And so what it does is, of course, reinforce the ability of rich people to enter these professions and strip away the ability of people coming from the working class to even begin to approach these professions. And at the same time, that is wrapped up in the student debt question. If you have to work your way through school and pay off your student debts, you are not going to be working an unpaid internship. Or you are and you'll be completely exhausted and unable to function. I mean, it's really an insane thing to expect from people, and absolutely re-solidifies class structure and privilege. Internships are absolutely a reinforcer of privilege. So then, right, if you take student debt as indenture, as Jeff Williams has done a great job of talking about in Dissent, that again restricts your freedom after college and puts the lie to the myth that if you go to college, that is a way of achieving a greater freedom after college to do the sort of work you love or to do the sort of work you will now be qualified to do. That is becoming a myth by means of student debt, which is quite tragic. And this language of investing in yourself is crazy, right? As a country, in theory, you know, the country thinking about it generationally is good. You know, you invest in the next generation, right? You take care of the country's young people. You make sure everyone is educated as sort of a basic human right. This has been sort of shifted over the last several years, and you've written about this, to a sort of language of investing in yourself, go deep into debt because it's an investment in your future possibilities. But what this really is a restraint on your future possibilities. You can't go do what you want if you're working off thousands and thousands of dollars of student debt. And that's a real emotional experience as well as a material one. And Jeff Williams has talked a lot about that too, what it feels like.
And it's interesting because when I read that piece, and we'll link to it in the links down below, you know, he points out the way indenture was set up originally. I mean, we think of it as a system of social control, which it is, but it's originally set up to solve an economic problem, which is a problem of travel and a problem of distance, which is there are workers in Europe who wanted to come to America, and it's expensive to get them there. So how do they do it? And the problem is when people – and I was talking to a friend of mine who's a very conservative economic historian or an economist who is a historian of economics. And I ran the thesis by him, and he loved it because, as he pointed out, the two biggest problems you would have with colonial era American indentured work is that people would die very quickly because there was disease and it was just life expectancy wasn't that high then, or they would run away, right? They would run west and start their whole life over again, and it was very easy to do that. So you needed indenture to be the system of social control that was, like, as the phrase would go, a total institution of a full control that extracted a lot of labor and a lot of labor very quickly. And as my conservative friend said, well, look, now people live a really long time and people can work productively after they're educated for decades. And there really isn't a place to run away to in that sense. I mean, in theory, you could go off the grid, but your abilities to really earn significant income are limited. And for a variety of reasons, you know, we have our ability for the government to see income is quite vast. And we've structured our laws on student debt to make sure that income is always that, you know, the government is a super creditor on student debt can take quite repressive means compared to, say, like credit card debt to get that money back. So in so much that there's still the same problem of travel, which is how do we get people who have significant talents to grow the economy to the spaces where that they have their talents fully developed and they're capable of exercising those abilities. How do we pay for that? And there is a mid-century model. There, you know, if you look at America up until certainly the 1980s, but perhaps even the 1990s, mass education was clearly a civil right and a civil goal, and mass higher education as well. Yeah. You know, I've been reading about the land grant acts from the 19th century during, you know, 1861, which, you know, fairly Republican state senators, fairly Republican senators who were saying, look, you know, we need to make sure that people in the West are educated to countervail the power of people in the East and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Stuff we just wouldn't even think about like nowadays in the way we talk about education.
Yeah.
And the way debt can function. And that's the interesting thing about the internship discussion is because, you know, my first knee-jerk reaction was, you know, this was a long time ago, was that this is actually, you know, kind of an equal opportunity thing, right? So everyone has to enter the internship, and people who can, it gives people who may not have insider connections an opportunity to really, you know, show off their talents in a way that, you know, it's not just about an insider connection to get a high-end job. But the flip side is you have to be able to feed yourself. You have to be able to survive in that time period. And that's exactly where we're not able to do under this kind of internship regime of labor. And so, and it's crucial. Like, I mean, these problems are not going away in the near future. They're only going to get more intense. Where do you see the kind of frontiers of these battles and discussions, both for kind of, you know, reproducing the meritocracy and also for people at marginalized spaces? Is it going to be a revival of different innovative techniques in unionization and worker rights? Where do you kind of see the frontier battles going, where people should be keeping their eyes?
Well, I think that there are very interesting groups working on new models of worker organization, and I do see the frontier being in these forms of organizing that look somewhat like the unions of old, but not exactly. So figuring out how to organize domestic workers and service economy workers, this is the frontier. There is no frontier except the power that workers can have for themselves to determine what their lives will be like. And so my interest in precarity intersects with this greatly. So if you take to pick a different example from exactly what we've been talking about, the Guest Worker Alliance is an organization that is not exactly a union, but helps people to organize themselves when they find themselves working in this country with no protection, no rights, often no legal status. We talk a lot about globalization and the pending changes having to do with increased circulation, not only of money and goods, but of people. And so frequently people working in this country, and this will only increase, of course, are not citizens of this country. And how you begin organizing those people is, I think, an equally interesting question, and certainly one frontier in this battle. The international left used to connect people across borders in different countries. Commonly, socialism was a common link that would allow people to form these networks and organize with one another. Dissent has a long-standing network of people writing from Eastern Europe and would send to Dissent what was happening there, what sort of organizing was happening there, what the problems were. And this is in some ways being revived in organizing. When people come to this country and are exploited, they often bring with them labor organizing practices from other countries. And a great example of this is a group of students, largely from Turkey, but I think other places as well, came to the States on a State Department program of cultural exchange and found themselves, I kid you not, locked in a Hershey's factory packaging chocolate and doing actually nice, very difficult, like brutal industrial labor. And this was done in order to displace unionized workers who had been working in that factory. The students got in touch with the Guest Worker Alliance, which helped them organize with the factory workers they had displaced. And they actually went on strike. They sat down in the factory, despite not being citizens, and then they marched through the town with the workers they had displaced because they realized what their economic function was there. And that is, I mean, that's a remarkable story. That is the frontier. That sort of finding that sort of commonality and that sort of power, I think, is not easy and not clear. Like, there are not existing mechanisms in law that facilitate that. But I think that's where we're going to see power necessarily emerging.
Interesting. One thing that, to kind of bring together some things we've been talking about, one thing about, a lot of people point out about precarity is that it involves a lot of work that has traditionally been coded female, particularly caring work, work of caring for older people, for children. And that, as it's pushed in the marketplace, is lacking a lot of traditional protections, and there needs to be innovation there to try to balance that for workers. But it obviously cues up an issue of feminism and the way feminism works with economic rights and the economy broadly. And one thing I really like about both your products, and in particular New Inquiry, there's a lot of really great female voices there as well. And there's been a lot of writing about the feminist blogosphere and how it's blown up and how, you know, there seems to be a lot of new innovations and ways people are talking about feminism online. There was a great New York Magazine piece about the feminist blogosphere from last fall that I thought was really, really fascinating because it really made the feminist, I think, I forgot who pointed this out. It might have been Erin Carman, who said, you know, it really makes the feminist blogosphere seem like we're all the interesting and dangerous and kind of far out there and people who are pushing the envelopes with ideas where, you know, I'm part of the blog, the, you know, economic wonky blogosphere, which, you know, it's obviously my bread and butter, but it feels like a perpetual job interview or, you know, like, you know, everything's always very polished and you're always trying to be a little bit, too reasonable, maybe even aggressively reasonable with other people. And often it doesn't have that kind of sporadic, you know, out there ideas in the way that traditionally feminism is always inoculated or always is always brought into the discussion. And you think and write a lot about ways feminism is evolving both in relation to the economy and relation to voices. So I'm kind of curious to get your sense of where feminism and the economy exists right now.
Yeah, and a lot of the things we're just discussing, of course, as you said, care work, a lot of these things have traditionally been female jobs. And as such, we're also regarded as sort of not real work and often not organized. And that's an increasing part of the economy. And people have called this the feminization of labor, which is where the way work traditionally done by women was often treated, which was as contingent because, you know, women, they get pregnant. So, you know, you can't expect to have them on for very long. Or in the sense of being just more easily exploited. Women lacked some of the organized, protected mechanisms that men more often belonged to, worked in these sort of de-unionized sectors, you know, and have generally been like the more easily exploited part of the workforce. Now we're seeing that sort of in all sectors. So people... you know, some places have fired all their workers and rehired them as freelancers so they don't have to pay them benefits. Well, women often have not had benefits because they're doing things like care work, which doesn't come with benefits. And so this idea is sort of interesting because it's a double-edged sword. You have on the one hand, my God, we're all having this experience that women have traditionally had. We need to find new ways to have more inclusive organizing. And on the other hand, you have the attitude, women are taking our jobs.
Right.
So that becomes difficult in that way. So feminism at this point, to paint with a really absurdly broad brush, really has to do with it must engage with this economic question. Because if the politics of work becomes women are taking our jobs, well, then we're really in trouble. And nothing particularly good is going to come out of that. One of the, you know, Nancy Fraser wrote this amazing New Left Review article a few years back on the state of feminism and how feminism has changed under neoliberalism. And one of her points was that, you know, for, sorry, I lost my train of thought slightly, but for the sort of organizing potential of women to be realized, there has to be this greater union of sort of bringing back together the way that men and women experience the economy, and instead sorry, I completely lost my train of thought, Mike.
No problem.
What am I going to do?
Let's back this up.
Let's back it up. All right.
If you were trying to summarize a long New Left Review piece and you only lost your train of thought once, I feel that that's still a victory.
So. I know. In fact, it would probably count against the New Left Review at this point if I could summarize one of their articles.
But a quick point is my colleague Bryce Kovrig writes quite a bit about women in the economy. And one thing you're actually seeing is while there's a small recovery going on, you're seeing a lot of men move into female-dominated work right now. Uh-huh. And this is something we saw last year. There's a big question among economic wonks last year about what was happening with women in the economy, because there's a little bit of a recovery. I mean, we were net putting on jobs, but they seem to predominantly go to men. especially beyond population growth, they were going to men. And what you saw is that a lot of men were moving into essentially in every industry. Pew put out this big survey, a big study of economic data, and saw that in every industry, men were outperforming women in terms of job gains.
Uh-huh.
And I believe, I'm not that familiar with this research yet, but I believe if you look at it right now, men are also seem to be getting paid more as they move into these sectors. So even within gendered work, there's still a gender wage gap and still an issue of who's getting paid. And I assume you'll, you know, as this expands, you'll see glass ceilings and glass elevators and so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
There's a question about, so there's a lot of feminism that's based around the idea of choice and opportunity and self-fashioning and self-entrepreneurship and the idea of I don't want to say necessarily just being a consumer and consumer place, but something where production and work and labor and how people are constructed along economic lines gets pushed into the background. And I'm curious how you see this feminism. You see this critique in a lot of different ways, one of which is Fraser's piece about how neoliberalization or how about the new economy of the past 30 years, which we'll use as a stand-in for that phrase, has subverted a lot of the class dynamics of feminism. You've read a lot of older feminism, feminist work from the 70s and even going back further. How has the relationship of the feminist project and economics changed over that time?
Good Lord, Mike. That's
in 30 seconds.
All right. Oh my God. Okay. So I think that one of the real strengths of a sort of socialist feminism in the 70s, of course, was taking a political economy approach to questions of sexist oppression, right? So how is the way that we arrange our families and our work relevant to the relationship between people of different genders? And this has over time shifted. So the emphasis has become, for example, if you want to take the academy, it's shifted somewhat from social theory, from thinking about the arrangement of people in the economy, to cultural theory, which is by no means useless, but everyone's favorite thing to mock, right? As sort of getting too academic, too cultural, too unconcerned with material relations of power and how women can be empowered under the economy as it exists. And certain strands of, and this is something Nancy Fraser is very good on, certain strands of feminist critique have been sort of pulled apart under neoliberalism and come to mean something else. So initially, the idea of the family wage was challenged, meaning it should not just be the man who earns the wage and the rest of the family is totally dependent on the man. And instead, we need to work out a way that we can have equal power within the family. And the way that this has been sort of perverted under neoliberalism, and I think a way that it often gets sort of reinterpreted now, is, okay, well, we all need to work. So everybody out into the workforce, a real decentering of care work, which really does matter, and putting some importance on care work was a goal of the now defunct, but Wages for Housework campaign, which was another strand of feminist argument. And so now you have both this ideal of both men and women entering the workforce. And instead of that creating some sort of equality, it means increasingly everybody works all the time. There's a larger exploitable workforce. More people are precarious and wages are lower. So this is not the intended outcome of feminist critique, right? This is not the world that was envisioned. But this is one way in which an ideal from that period that's very economically grounded has, due to the way the economy has moved forward and also the way that the critique has been reshaped, been sort of perverted into something that I would consider not particularly feminist. And certainly not the sort of economic system I want to live under. So I would say that's one example of that sort of evolution.
So to step back from kind of feminist theory and kind of frontiers of the more theoretical, critical discussion is, as a matter of both political, as a matter of policy, and as a matter of kind of the political organization, there's always been a fight, especially in the past several decades, but, you know, increasing since 2004, about a conflict between emphasizing what are cultural issues and what are economic issues. And the kind of classic statement everyone knows about this is, what's the matter with Kansas?
Right.
Where Thomas Frank says, you know, writing to moderate Republicans like he was when he grew up, you know, essentially said, you know, you're getting bamboozled on these cultural issues when you're getting screwed on these economic issues. But underlining that was like the idea that the cultural issues are either a distraction in and of themselves or that to the extent like that they shouldn't be won, right? You had a lot of liberals read that and say, you know, Thomas Frank essentially says, you know, Democrats should not say that cultural issues are really important, you know, or that that there's a real cleaved line you could put between the two. And you see this in a lot of different ways, right? So my personal favorite is after 2004, when there was talks about a permanent Republican majority, you had a lot of liberal writers say the best thing for the Democrats is if Roe v. Wade is overruled, because it will create a wave. There's like New Republic articles about this. I forgot where else you saw it, but the total, like, brilliant logic of 2005 Democrats, who would then go on to win a gigantic majority just because the other side screwed up so much. But, like,
I'm glad we didn't overturn Roe v. Wade in the meantime.
Right. But, like, the idea, like, well, once it gets really bad for women, they'll realize they got, and men too, but especially women, you know, then we'll finally vote for John Kerry. You also see it with ways of trying to understand Governor Cuomo of New York, which is on one hand, he passed gay marriage, and on another hand, President Obama, you know, there's a lot of advancements on gay marriage, which will extend rights to a lot of people and normalize and help bring people into the community. But on the other hand, Governor Cuomo's Kate Redburn, who's often contributes to the New Inquiry, wrote at Jacobin about, on the other hand, you know, he's cut funding for homeless shelters and a huge number of homeless shelters function to help teenage runaway people who are GLBTQ. And, you know, on one hand, you know, culture, you see culture, and a lot of people point this out in different ways. On one hand, there's an expansion of culture issues, but it seems like it's constraining down the economic rights. But as someone who myself thinks the culture issues matter quite a bit, how do you thread the needle between the two? How do you find a way to emphasize both?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think using, for example, Kate's problem with the gay marriage question, I think that's a fabulous example. So here's why. I would say that Cuomo, first of all, so Obama recently sort of quasi declared his support for gay marriage, but Cuomo actually managed to pass it. He passed it with the help of very, very large New York donors. And then, yes, he cut funding for homeless shelters that serve LGBTQ youth. So if you want to address this as a cultural question, I don't see why the freedom of LGBTQ youth to live as themselves and presumably escape restraint and repression over people who don't accept them for who they are. You know, there's a reason they're not living at home. I don't see why their freedom to be themselves is any less a cultural issue than someone else's right to marry. And so then the question is, you know, between those two cultural issues, who is vulnerable? And I would say the youth. So it is a question of emphasis. I actually don't have a problem per se with passing gay marriage. I have a huge problem with cutting funding that essentially protects vulnerable people who are made vulnerable by their identity. And that is where sort of cultural and personal identity and economics intersect. And to me, the measure of good politics is it helping people who need it? Is it empowering those people to make their own choices as they would choose? And And in the case of homeless shelters, I think that's just a clear-cut question. Those are the most vulnerable people, and it engages a cultural issue as well. So I think that's how you thread that needle.
And just to bring it back a bit, you're seeing a lot of innovations and people talking about ways in which that project hangs together for conservatives. On the right, Corey Robbins' book, The Reactionary Mind, is very big on the idea that, you know, economic and cultural issues are all about hierarchy, and they're all about the power of the boss or the husband over the workplace or the home. And I think it's actually a very elegant way of making that hang together. The critique side, I think you're starting to see more people talk about positive freedom and economic rights. But I think it's really fascinating, as you brought up earlier, that feminism could be one frontier to link those two issues together more closely than they have been in the recent past. And to kind of conclude a little bit, how would you like to see discourse around feminist theory like evolve to kind of bring in both of those issues, which are both very important?
Well, I would like to see it reengage with certainly with questions of class and economics. And that's actually not an easy question, because that is not popularly how it's been done recently. Nina Power wrote a wonderful sort of pamphlet called One Dimensional Woman, which I'd recommend to everybody. It's sort of great. And she says in it, there's a very real way in which women have been conditioned, when asked what they want, to say chocolate. I think that's probably true. I think that's kind of a problem.
Have you ever seen the online thing of women smiling eating salad? We'll put the link to it if we
can. I have. An invention of, where was that? Was that their hairpin?
Yeah. I think it was hairpin. It was pretty brilliant when they collected all these images, but yes.
Right. Because, you know, like the sort of image of like the sort of naughty girl is like eating chocolate, and the like healthy girl is eating salad. Like, I mean, these are ridiculous frameworks for understanding women, right? This is totally absurd. But these are popular images, and they're sort of all pervasive. Sex in the City feminism, sort of feminism being the ability to buy as many pairs of shoes as you like. This is a language of feminism as the ability to have stuff for yourself. And if you are a woman and you have stuff, that is feminism. And I would like to see a transition, of course, away from that and into these questions about work that we discussed before, and how feminism can reengage with actually bringing together women of different classes, not just in understanding, but in figuring out how we build power in the face of this change in this new instability, when it's easier to be fired, and women are always fired first. And that's true on Wall Street as much as it is in domestic work, actually. At the peak of the economic crisis, all the women who were just about to be CEOs, leaving aside a question for a moment, the question of whether we want anyone to be a CEO of one of these disastrous institutions, all of the women who were poised to be the first CEOs were fired. And so we see sort of a common question there that's well worth engaging with, and we've all seen, well, probably not if you work in publishing, you've seen the numbers of women being published in magazines, and they're still significantly lower than men. And so I talk to other female editors and try and figure out how to change this, but then the fact remains that you still have a bunch of sort of often white, middle class, highly educated women reinforcing the empowerment of each other's voices. And so that doesn't go far enough either. And so building these intersections of race, gender, and class, making sure that those are central again, and thinking about women as actors in the economy, that's important and really, really exciting. And something I think the sort of new experimental labor organizing forms are directly engaging with, particularly care work. And I think that's sort of the space that people should watch for the really exciting organizing models.
One last question to conclude. Fraser obviously talks about this kind of fracturing of women's solidarity under a new regime of the economy over the past 30 years, what was often referred to as neoliberalization. There's a book called Age of Fracture by the U.S. intellectual historian Daniel Rogers, which is to me, one of the best books I've read in quite some time. I want to make sure I got the name right on that. Yeah, Daniel T. Rogers. And it's his history of the past 30 or 40 years. And he talks about feminism. And to him, one of the problems, the title is Fracture, and the idea is that any type of more solid identity has essentially, melted into air, to use the common phrase, but it's fractured along individualized lines. And he talks about feminism in the 70s, and he talks a lot about Carol Gillian's In a Different Voice, and the idea that there was this kind of essence of femininity or femaleness that you could create a solidarity and kind of a consciousness around, outside of just strictly class. So obviously, class influences a lot of it. And when you look at something like Judith Butler, 15 years later, the whole identity of the whole idea that there's this essential nature of women is kind of collapsed into this idea that it's constructed very far down in the kind of identity area. How much do you think there needs to be that kind of more solidarity among women qua women and the idea of, women's space, so to speak, of identity? Or, how much further alongside class does it need to go, do you think? I'm kind of throwing this question at you out of left field.
Yeah, I think these things are often framed as choices. Do you care about class? Do you care about gender? That's not really the way it works, right? Like, all these things enforce each other. Yes, depending on some sort of essence of femininity would not work now. But the way to think about it, I think, is to think, instead of thinking, I'm a feminist, so the thing I care about is gender, thinking, I advocate feminism, meaning, I advocate getting rid of the structures that reinforce sexist oppression. So the point of sort of this sort of reframing is just to say that the structures that reinforce sexist oppression may in fact be a lack of a union or maybe something else. But if you can be fired when you get pregnant, that's sexism. That's also the lack of a union. So I think assuming that these things are completely bound up in each other is very important. And Fraser does talk about the feminist critique of economism, of thinking that the only thing that matters is class. And if you can sort of bind these things up and think about them always relationally as sort of a networked system, then you can begin to, instead of making choices between gender and class, understand sort of more holistically how they're all reinforcing each other, and sort of begin to pick apart the structures that are doing that. And if you talk to if you listen to like Joyce Gill Campbell, who's with the domestic workers, she'll say that explicitly. She'll say, the current labor laws are not designed to take care of people who do this important work. And it's partly because of business pressure during the New Deal era, but it's also a function of racism, trying to, winning the Southern Democrats, as you discussed earlier. And it's also made easier by the fact that people do not consider women's work in the home to be real labor. So they all work together.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I encourage everyone who's watched to check out New Inquiry and Dissent, and follow us as well as Fireside Chats. Thank you for joining me, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Take care.